Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another shiur about tefillah fundamentals. We thank you for joining us on this Tuesday evening. So previous weeks, we spoke about the idea of tefillah as a relationship, as a way in which we create a relationship with Hashem, where we acknowledge that He is the one who gives us everything, and we acknowledge that we are very much in need of those things. And tefillah is a reflexive process where we're trying to internalize that value, and the sooner we realize that we need Hashem, the sooner we realize that He is the source of everything, that might be a way to access the things that we need. And we ended off last week by asking the question of what exactly is the role of Kavana in this process? Because I'll be the first to admit, I don't always daven with 100% Kavana. And I'll leave it at that. It's very hard. It's very hard for us to focus. Now, I originally advertised this year to be titled, How to Daven Without Kavana. But I realized I was getting a little ahead of myself. Because, yes, that will be the topic for next week, but why should we already assume that we're not going to have Kavana? Let's first give it a shot. Let's first see if we could present some strategies for how we actually can improve our Kavana. But let's start by really asking the question of what is so important about Kavana? Well, if you have come the last few weeks, it sounds like a silly question. Of course Kavana is important. The whole point of tefillah is to have a relationship. So how could there be that process without knowing what you're talking to, who you're talking to, what you're saying? In addition, there is an expression that goes back at least 700 years, and that is the expression of tefillah below kavana, kiguf below neshama. That tefillah without kavana is like a body without any life, without any neshama inside of it. Tefillah might be the words of tefillah, the standing still, opening a book, might be the structure of tefillah. What really gives tefillah life? Oh, hearing an echo. Okay. What really gives tefillah life, what gives it the ability to actually take on something special, is that fact that it has kavana. In source number 1 and 2, the Gemara has an expression that, how could a person talk to Hashem without kavana? Is God just your friend that you just absentmindedly text Him without thinking what you're saying? Oh, sorry, 17 typos, autocorrect got the best of me. No, how could a person discuss with Hashem anything without taking the time first to think about what he wants to say? In source number 3, Rabbeinu Bachai, who I mentioned last week, one of the Rishonim, has a parash al HaTorah. He has an interesting understanding of what it's like when a person davens without kavana. There's a pasuk at the end of Parshas Yisro that says, Hashem warns us, Lo sasuni ti Elohei chesef Elohei zahav lo sasu lachem. Do not make with me gods of silver and idols of gold. What does it mean to make with Hashem gold and silver? Are we partnering with Hashem making avodah zarah? And Rabbeinu Bachai says something amazing. He says that when a person is davening to Hashem and he's thinking about his business, he's thinking about his gold and silver, it's like avodah zarah. You're talking to Hashem. What are you really thinking about? You're thinking about your gold and your silver. You're thinking about your bank account. In a way, he calls that it's avodah zarah. You're mixing your conversation with Hashem while your mind is at the office. Frightening. And just before we tone it down and become less frightened, let me just put one more frightening thought out there. In source number 4, the Tiferes Yisrael, this is one of the classic commentaries of Mishnayos, written in the early 1800s. He writes that at the end of davening, we have a phrase that we say, Yehu l'ratzon refi, my words should be l'ratzon, pleasant and effective, v'hagyon li b'lefanecha, and my thoughts should be in front of you. How many of us can get to Shmona Esrei at the end and feel confident with those words? Hashem should take my thoughts seriously. What if we spent the whole Shmona Esrei thinking about ridiculous things? Do we want Hashem to take Hegyon Libi? Do we want Him to take all the things we were thinking about? I don't know about that. That's what he writes in source number 4. How can a person not be embarrassed to say, please take my thoughts, if in reality a person's thoughts are all over the place? Okay, so this is nothing new. We already know the idea that it's important to have Kavana. But let's just be more specific. What exactly do we mean when we say Kavana? Kavana for what? So, as kids were taught, Kavana means you have to know what you're saying. You have to learn the Perish Hamilim. You have to understand the words and what they mean. Rav Chaim Brisker, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, 100 years ago, he has an amazing idea where he talks about two different types of Kavana. There's the standard Kavana I just mentioned, the idea of knowing what you're saying when you're saying it. But also, the idea of just knowing you're davening to Hashem. Just to be aware that you are standing in Hashem's presence, which fits very well with our theme the last few weeks, the idea of tefillah being a relationship. Hashem gives us tzaros, He gives us a way, a wake-up call, a reminder to have a relationship with Him. So tefillah is that mindset of knowing, of understanding we are in Hashem's presence and we're talking to Hashem. the second level of kavana. And Reb Chaim writes something amazing. He says that it's not necessarily a matter of kavana. It's a matter of tefillah. If you don't have the second aspect of kavana, if you don't know that you're talking to Hashem, that you're standing in Hashem's presence, then you're not davening. You're not davening at all. Because who are you talking to? Talking to yourself? Kavana, understanding you're in Hashem's presence, is the only way tefillah is a real experience. The only way you're actually talking to Hashem. Reb Chaim goes so far to say that a person who doesn't have that recognition, doesn't feel that at any part during Shmona Esrei, could invalidate the entire Shmona Esrei. You could ruin the entire Shmona Esrei by not feeling at all times that you're in Hashem's presence. That's an outrageous, very strict, very serious chumrah to say that a person who doesn't have that mindset the entire 19 brachos is as if he or she did not say those brachos. So the Achronim don't accept this lahalacha. Shlomo Zalman, the Chazon Ish, they don't accept this lahalacha. A person might be yotze even when he doesn't have this exact kavana. But just fundamentally, it's important to understand what we mean when we say having kavana. Not just understanding the words that we're saying, but really picturing ourselves, really imagining ourselves standing in front of Hashem. This idea is spelled out in source number 6 in Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch writes, a person has to know the words that they're saying, but also a person has to picture the Shekhinah in front of them. And there the Shulchan Aruch ends off that a person has to picture before davening that Hashem, just how wonderful, how great, how powerful Hashem is, and just how needy we are, which fits perfectly of our theme for the last few weeks. It's exactly what tefillah is all about, creating this relationship with Hashem by understanding just how needy we are, and that Hashem is the answer to everything we need. Okay, so this is nothing new. We know the importance of Kavana. Reb Chaim added a new element. It's not just knowing what we're saying, but just recognizing that we're standing in Hashem's presence. Here's the problem. You know what the problem is? I'll tell you the problem. Remember one time, I was at the office, and I had a very important email to write. It was to my boss. It was about a very sensitive issue, and the wording of the email was very important. I just found myself like stopping and really thinking just about what exactly to say in the email. And I remember backspacing and deleting and kept trying again and again. And at some point while I'm working on this email, somebody hit me. Someone just punched me. I was very taken aback, and I looked around, and before I could even gather my thoughts and realize what was going on, it happened again. Someone just hit me right in the chest. And I looked down, and I realized that I wasn't at the office. I was in shul, and I was davening Slach Lanu. I thought I was at the office. That's where my thoughts were. And that's where I was. Sometimes the idea of Slach Lanu as a wake-up call, it can be really awkward, especially on Shabbos. Often Friday night, people are davening and their eyes are closed and they're looking around and they're davening and absentmindedly they start saying the weekday Shmona Esrei in place of the Shabbos one. And they don't realize until they get to Slach Lanu. They don't realize until they hit themselves in the chest and they look around like, did anybody see me? See, until now, no one knew, but this is awkward. People are looking at me. So the typical thing you do is you scratch yourself, you stretch, you pretend I wasn't really doing anything. The story before about being at the office, that wasn't my own story. That's a mashal given by Rav Shalom Shvadron, the Maggid of Yerushalayim. But let me tell you a story that actually happened that I witnessed myself. I remember a number of years ago, I was visiting a certain yeshiva, and I was next to this person, this fine-looking young bacher, and I don't know anything about this guy, but Friday night, during Shmona Esrei, he started to hit himself. Now, it distracted me because it made a loud sound and it caught my attention. Okay, but what do you typically do? You typically scratch yourself and you keep on going. But this person wanted to cover it up so well. He decided that, no, this is how I always daven. What do you mean? I always hit myself when I daven all the time. And he just kept going and going. The whole Shmona Esrei, he kept pounding himself and pulling on his jacket and shaking in the most ridiculous way. Now, I don't know if that person had kavana, but I certainly didn't. I wasn't able to focus on anything with that person, Tarzaning it up over there. And this happens all the time. We're not even having that second level that Reb Chaim talked about, this idea of understanding where we are, of knowing that we're in the presence of Hashem, that we're trying to do a process of davening over here. Now, we shouldn't feel bad. This idea did not start with me, didn't start with that person that I was davening next to, didn't start with Rav Shalom Shvadron. This idea goes back not only 500 or 1,000 years ago, it goes back to the time of the Gemara. In source number 7, and we'll discuss this a lot more next week when we talk about davening without Kavana. In source number 7, the Amoraim, thousands of years ago, times of the Gemara, they also had this exact same problem. Rav Masanya, one of the Amoraim, said in source number 7, Ana mechazek tivu l'roshi. I really got to thank my head. The charhava mati modim, when it gets to modim, hu kara migarmei. It bows on its own. I have no idea what's going on, he said. I'm davening. I don't know where I am. I don't know what I'm saying. But when I get to Modim, my body, my head just knows to bow on its own. It's not a new problem. The idea of davening and not knowing where you are and having your body, your slachlan, your head bowing wake you up, it's not a new phenomenon. It goes way back. Even the greatest of people have struggled. What exactly does it mean to daven with kavana? How are we supposed to really have that feeling when we daven so many times? On the one hand, we're privileged to talk to Hashem so many times a day. But on the other hand, we say the same words over and over again, and it's got monotonous. So how are we supposed to wake ourselves up before the slachlanu hits us, before we have to find our head bowing without realizing? So I wanted to share some ideas tonight about how to daven with kavana. Some of the ideas are classic. And some idea I want to present to you at the end, a new idea, not necessarily a new idea, but a new perspective, a new way of framing the idea that really has given me meaning over the last few months when I've started seeing it this way, and I hope you'll find it meaningful as well. So the first step in having kavana, in terms of recognizing we're standing in front of Hashem, we're speaking to Hashem, is to prepare before davening. Like anything else meaningful, the preparation you put in really matters. You can't just show up somewhere and say, I'm here, now I want to have a very productive time. No, whether it's making a simcha, or it's going to law school, whatever it is that we're going to be doing requires proper preparation. And the same is true of tefillah as well. And this is especially true when it comes to the setting. When I was in third grade, we learned about setting, writing a story. Setting meant time and place. It's very important to focus on having a proper time and place for davening. In source number 8, Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the Rishonim in 1200s, he writes the importance of having a set place for davening. The Gemara talks about having a makam kavua for davening. And we think of Makom Kavua as a certain place in shul where we davening. And that's correct. Makom Kavua does mean having a set place in shul. But Rabbeinu Yonah didn't really think so. He thought that Makom Kavua was most important in one's home. If you daven in shul, who cares if you daven on this bench or that bench? We happen to paskin that you're supposed to have a set place in shul itself. But Rabbeinu Yonah said, listen to me. What's most important is to have a set place in your house. When you're in shul, you're in a special place. And you're at home, where there's kids running around, where there's distractions all around the house, it's most important to have a set place in the house. And unfortunately, we've had to daven at home for so long. The last few months, we found ourselves davening biyachidus, davening in our homes, much more often than we usually did. It became ever more important to have a makam kavua, to have a place which is free of distraction, a place that's quiet, a place that's familiar. We're not looking around and saying, how long have those cobwebs been there? No, I'm davening in the same place every single day. I'm not looking around, I'm not noticing new things, I'm not in a place with full of distractions. I pick a place in my house that I'm able to focus. That's step one of prepping for davening, picking a good place to daven. Source number 9, the Rambam discusses the idea of finding a good time to daven, and not just choosing a good time of day. You know, if you're going to daven on the subway after work, when you're exhausted and it's crowded and it's noisy, it's not a good time to daven. So, even when you come to shul, you run into shul and you run into Shmona Esrei. You're still thinking about the bad parking spot you got, or whether you have to go back later and put money in the meter. A person runs into shul without really having time to stop and think. It can really take away from one's kavana. And the Rambam recommends that a person should stop for a moment. In the Gemara, it says that people, the great earlier righteous people, would stop for an hour. They'd prepare for davening for an entire hour. But the Rambam says, just a moment, just stop before you daven and just take a deep breath. Just pause for a second before you daven and think about, who am I talking to? Reb Chaim's idea of not just knowing what I'm saying, but at least to understand where I am. Not in the office. I'm standing in front of Hashem, and to stop for a moment, to find a good time, to find a good place, that's the way to prep before davening. Okay, so these are well-known ideas, the idea of having a good time, a good place to daven. But I want to make a suggestion about during davening itself. Obviously, preparing properly is the key. But once davening starts, even if we have the best preparation, how long does it last for? Let's be honest. How long does it really take for us to start wandering around and going to the office and going here and going there? And the idea I want to suggest that really can help us regather our focus is the idea of shuckling. Now, I don't really mean shuckling per se, though that's one example we're going to talk about. I just mean the idea of physically moving. If you look at source number 10, in the Shulchan Aruch, the Rama writes that there's an old minug to shuckle when one learns, to shuckle when one davens. Very old minug. So where does it come from? Where's the idea of shuckle? Very Jewish idea to shuckle. You don't see like politicians shuckle when they speak. Unless they're really old and like might faint. But like you don't see politicians really shuckling like that. So it's a Jewish idea. Where did Jews get the idea of shuckling from? So interesting, Yehuda Halevi in the Sefer Kuzari, over 1,000 years ago, he writes that he thinks that perhaps the idea of shakaling came from people before the printing press or a very limited sfar, and have to take turns using the book. One person leaned in, one person leaned out. You have to take turns using the same book. Okay, maybe it's true, but it's definitely not the most inspiring idea about why we shakal. But the Ramah has a different idea. The Ramah quotes from earlier sources in source number 10. He writes, when people daven, there's an old minhag to shakal because the pasuk in Tehillim that we quote in Nishmas on Shabbos, Kol atzmosai tomarna Hashem michamocha. All of my bones, every fiber of my body screams out to Hashem, a praise Hashem who is like you. We daven, we praise Hashem with our bodies. When we shakal, we are using our bodies to praise Hashem. What does that mean? What does that mean? When we shakal, when we move our bodies, we are calling out to Hashem. So I want to share with you this idea. This idea is very exciting to me, because for those who don't know, I'm currently finished my second year of doctoral studies. I'm going for a PsyD in child psychology. And in the world of education, the world of research in terms of proper classroom management and the best educational strategies, there is an idea of increasing the number of modalities in which material is taught. The old school way was, you sit down, you listen, and if you don't, I have this ruler. But modern times don't accept that for good reason. But we also don't want it to just be a lecture. Research shows that if we have not just sitting and listening or participating or answering questions, but getting up once in a while, moving, having a show and tell, having an experiment, having a way to actually physically get involved, it doesn't only increase attention and focus, but also helps us internalize the material a lot better. When people act it out, when people get a chance to physically touch it and do it, it makes it much more real to ourselves. So I was very excited. You know, someone should figure out a way to include physical action in tefillah. If you want to make tefillah more meaningful, we should follow these studies. We should find a way to include physical action in tefillah. And then it hit me. Like a slach lanu, it hit me. We do physical action in tefillah. There's so much physical action in tefillah. We're going to go through a whole list in just a few minutes, but the way that we stand, that we stand, how we stand, feet together, bowing, three steps forward, three steps back, slach lanu, there's so many things that we're going to talk about that we do. Tefillah is a full body experience. But why doesn't it work? Are the studies wrong? Why doesn't the physical actions that we incorporate into tefillah, why don't they do anything? So I want to share with you a beautiful mashal of the Dubna Magid. Dubna Magid was a contemporary of the Vilna Gaon in the 1700s, and he was legendary for having a mashal for everything. Somebody once asked him, why do you always have a mashal for everything? And he said, let me tell you with a mashal. You know, when a parent tries to get the kids to take medicine, sometimes the kid doesn't want to open up their mouth. Or in my kid's case, getting them to brush their teeth. So what do? You make them smile. You tell them something interesting. You tell them a joke. You tickle them. And once the mouth is open, you can stick the nutrients or the toothbrush into their mouth. So he says, same thing over here. I have an important message to share. People's hearts aren't always open. So I tell them an interesting story. I tell them something to make them laugh. And once they're open, I can impart the meaningful message. And someone else once asked the Magid, well, how do you always have the perfect mashal for everything? And it's a great question. Here's a mashal. And he told the mashal about, the famous mashal about the idea of shooting the arrows and drawing the bullseyes around the arrow. He first looks at situations, and once he sees what exactly is going on, he thinks, what is this a mashal for? And he's compiled, over the years, he compiled thousands and thousands of mashalim that seem to fit the circumstances perfectly. So let me share you what he says about the idea of tefillah and the idea of shuckling, the idea of physical movement in tefillah. He told the story about an innocent peddler from a very simple, small town who one time for business went to travel to the large, big city, the very sophisticated city, where he spent a few months working on his business, working on his management. And while he was there, one night a fire broke out. One of the homes across the street was on fire. And he goes to the window and he sees with amazement one of the people goes out of the house, not carrying a bucket of water, but carrying a gigantic pot and a wooden spoon. And this person goes to the middle of the street and starts banging and banging on the pot, making a gigantic ruckus in the middle of the night. And this simple farmer, simple peddler, he's so confused, what exactly is going on? And he's amazed that quickly people come with buckets of water from all areas of the city. They come over and put out the fire within 5 minutes and basically avert a major crisis. And he's so inspired, this is a great idea. So he goes back to his own town, and a few months later, a fire breaks out. One of his neighbors, a fire breaks out in the middle of the night. And everyone's scrambling to find some water. And he says, no, we don't need water. I know exactly what to do. So he goes into his house and he pulls out the biggest pot he has and a wooden spoon and he starts banging on the pot. And his neighbors, people in town, are thinking, what is wrong with this guy? There's a fire in one of these houses. We have to get water. He goes, no, we don't need water. Trust me, I was in the big city. This is how the sophisticated people do. And he starts banging and banging on the pot. People are standing around watching him until the house burns down. Quickly, they ignore the guy. They run to get their own water. And eventually, they put out the fire. And the guy is devastated. He feels like He wasn't able to properly bring over this sophisticated idea to his small town. And someone explained it to him. Look, I was also in that town. I see what they do. The pot and the spoon are not putting out the water. The pot and the spoon are just calling into action the people who are already assigned, they're already on call, they have firefighters, they have people who are trained to have access to water to come and put it out in the most efficient way. And the job of the alarm, the job of the siren is just to get their attention, to wake them up and to get them outside. But you have to have the people who are trained behind that. Once you already have people whose job it is to do that, then the alarm wakes them up and gets them out. You can't just have the alarm, you can't just have the banging, that's not going to accomplish anything. If anything, it's the opposite. It's much worse. If you hadn't been banging, we would have gotten water ourselves. You actually distracted us from taking care of the fire. The Divna Magid explained that this is really what's happening when people, they shuckle and they bang, they slach lanu, they bow. So much physical action in tefillah. You might look at someone else and the person shuckling and davening, and you think, wow, that person has amazing kavana. I also want to bang. I also want to jump up and down and clap my hands and look up to the sky and bow and step forward and step backward. I also want to do all those things. But the truth is, the banging and the screaming is not itself a solution. If you've already worked out a system for how to deal with something, for how to have kavana, then when you bang and you scream and you shake and you do all those physical actions, then it calls out all those things. It's ma'orer, wakes up all those who are sleeping and helps you focus. But you have to take the time first to stop and actually work out what these things mean. The pot only has meaning because it signals the firefighters. What does the shuckling mean? What does banging your chest mean? What does bowing mean? What does keeping your head low? What does putting your hands together for tefillah mean? We're going to talk about all these different things that we do, all these physical actions. The studies are not wrong. Physical action is great, but only if it's representing something else. If we can actually understand what it is they represent, to understand that we're calling to action a bunch of very special ideas. And that's the idea of shuckling. Not just shuckling like this, but physical movement. It can really incorporate a major aspect of kavana. It's that wake-up call with the slach lanu, or as the Gemara said, bowing your head. These are amazing wake-up calls. You know what? We already do all these things. We already do all these things. We don't have to make up new physical modalities of having kavana, of remembering Hashem is there, remembering we're talking to Hashem, of feeling submissive, of feeling needy. We do them anyway. But if we're just banging without realizing what they represent, then not only are we doing something not good, we're distracting ourselves from actually focusing, just like the person distracted everybody else from taking care of the fire. And that's why what I want to spend the next couple minutes on is just discussing some of these ideas, what these represent. Just you'll see just how many physical things we do with all parts of our body. Now, I don't want to just rattle off 100 different things, nor is that productive. At the end, I even have a list, a nice neat summary of all these different ideas, which I'll share with you at the end. In the next few minutes, try not to focus on just any particular one detail. Just get a picture of just how many things that we do and what is behind these ideas, what exactly we're trying to be ma'orer, what it is we're waking up when we do all these things. And sometimes there's conflicting values. In source number 11, the Mishnah Berurah writes that there are those who are very into shuckling and there are those who are not. And he writes, do whatever's best for your kavana. There's no rule, there's no mitzvah, thou shalt shuckle. No, shuckling is just a tool. It's the pot, it's the spoon, it's just a way of waking up. If for one person standing still, absolutely petrified, is a better way to have kavana, do that. I read that Moshe Feinstein used to daven like that. He wouldn't shuckle at all. He would stand absolutely still. And someone once had the chutzpah, the courage, to ask him, why do you daven like that? How come you don't shuckle like the yeshiva guys do? And he said, I remember when I was in Russia, and one time, I don't remember the exact circumstance, but I was in Russia, and one of the generals came over to speak to me. I was petrified. I stood absolutely at attention. When talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I want to recreate that same feeling, that same petrified Omed Lifnei HaMelech, Reb Chaim's idea of not just what we're saying, but just recognize you're standing in the presence of the King. For some people, shuckling helps us keep us alive instead of just being stiff and being bland. For other people, standing perfectly still makes us feel like we're shaking, makes us feel like we're actually in the presence of someone great. Another idea, what we do with our bodies, is we stand up during Shmona Esrei. In source number 12, the Shulchan Aruch writes that one of the ideas why we stand for Shmona Esrei is tefillah is like a karban. It's an avoda. And when the Kohanim did the avoda, they had to stand up. For us, our tefillah is an avoda. And just like the avoda, he writes, cannot have any foreign machshavos. If the Kohen has foreign machshavos while he's offering the karban, different times to eat the karban, different places to eat the karban is invalid. One can invalidate their tefillah if they have foreign ideas. By standing up, we remind ourselves that we're like Kohanim doing the Avodah, and we have to focus ourselves. next time you shift from foot back to foot because it's getting uncomfortable to stand still, that's a reminder. It's a wake-up call. It's another slach lanu. It's another physical action that we do. It's banging on the pot. As long as we know what it represents, it's a reminder. Shulchan goes on that the idea of a person has to bow, not just bow during the parts that we know about, but a person's supposed to keep their head low. A person should be submissive. The idea we talked about of recognizing that we need Hashem. The idea of standing with a humble posture. Keeping the head covered in source number 14. The idea of whether it's a hat or a tichel or a talus, whatever keeps our head, recognizing there's someone above us. If it's a talus, keeping the blinders on so we don't get distracted. The sources go on. The idea of our eyes. Where should our eyes be during tefillah? And again, you don't have to memorize any of these things. Just get the idea. Look how much meaning there is in each of the physical things that we're doing anyway. There's a discussion in source number 16. Is it better for a person to have their eyes open, look in the sitter? Better to have their eyes closed? All these different ideas. You know what? Try alternating. If you daven with your eyes closed and it's getting boring, so try once in a while looking in a sitter. If you always daven looking in a sitter and it's getting boring, try closing your eyes and picturing the words. Try picturing yourself in front of Hashem. Source number 18 is a pasuk in Megillas Esther that many, Vilnagon and others, used to use as a melitza, as an expression, as like a cute way of reminding us the importance of davening from a sitter. The pasuk says, "Ubevo'a lifnei ha-melech, amar im ha-sefer, yashuv machashavto hara'a," which can be read out of context to mean, when one approaches the king, when one approaches Hashem, amar im ha-sefer, daven with a sefer, look inside, and that will help return, help push away all the bad thoughts. What should our hands be doing during davening? One approach in source 19 is to hold a sitter. Maybe we should hold a sitter during davening. Other ideas in source 20 and on, the idea of a person folding their hands together, putting your hands over your heart. The idea of one rubbing their hands together. It's one of the ideas in source 22. The idea shows humility. It shows that we're beseeching Hashem. We're begging Hashem. I like to think of the idea, I'm not sure exactly who Igor is, but it's like the quintessential bald hunchback henchman who rubs his hand together and he goes, "Yes, master." Right? Rubbing your hands together could be that kind of idea, a physical action that we do to symbolize, yes, we're a little bit nervous when approaching Hashem and we're beseeching Him, we're asking Him for something. Put the hands out like you're asking Hashem to give you something. And lastly is the idea of our feet. Aside from the idea of standing, we keep our feet together. So many beautiful ideas, you'll see on the list at the end, beautiful ideas about why we keep our feet together. I mentioned in the first year, the Maharsha, the idea about keeping our feet together, chained up like we're davening in front of Hashem, like we're avadim. Other ideas and quoted in the Beis Yosef is about when we keep our feet together, we're showing we're not going anywhere. I think of a baseball player on first base. When they stretch their legs out, they're taking the lead. They're ready to run. No. When we daven, we have our feet together. We're anchoring ourselves right over here. We're not running anywhere. There's so many beautiful ideas, and we can alternate. You'll see the list at the end, just to take a moment to realize just how many things we do. When we walk forward in source 24, take three steps forwards to picture that we're approaching Hashem. We're walking forward to Hashem to ask Him for what we need. And we take three steps back, we're like leaving the king. We're walking back respectfully. Take leave of the king. Again, I don't want to overwhelm you with a million different sources. That's not the point. Just recognize just how many physical things that we do in Shmona Esrei. It's not just lip service. We're not just talking. Our head is involved, our eyes are involved, our lips are involved, our shoulders are involved, our back is involved, our legs are involved, our knees are involved, our feet, everything is involved. There's so much that we do with our physical bodies. And it's just another avenue, another way to be Ma'or Kavana. Imagine you're during Shmona Esrei and you don't just have the Slach Lanus to wake you up. Every time you bow your knees, you think to yourself, oh yeah, what does that mean again? When I bang with the spoon on the pot, what am I waking up? What is behind that symbol? What is behind the siren? I forget what that is again. Oh yeah, standing together means that I'm standing in front of Hashem, humble, bent. All these things have an amazing message. And perhaps, I'm not sure if this is what he was literally saying, but perhaps that could be one way of understanding Rav Masanya back in the days of the Gemara when he said, I thank my head for bowing when I wasn't paying attention. Simply, it could just mean, thanks for covering me. I wasn't going to remember. Thanks for remembering. But it also could be, thanks for waking me up. I wasn't paying attention. But there's a built-in reminder when I bow my head, when I bow my knees, when I look up, when I look down, when I close my eyes, hold a sefer. There's so many things that we do anyway. Just an amazing opportunity. What the Rama said, Kol Atzmo Sai Tomarna. My entire body screams out. All of my body is talking. All of my body is involved in this beautiful process of tefillah, helping us feel submissive, helping us feel needy, helping us recognize just how great Hashem is, and just how powerful He is, and how He has the ability to help us. That is the yesod of tefillah we've been talking about for the last few weeks. And our physical actions can help us achieve Reb Chaim's second level of kavana, to recognize that we are not just know what we're saying, which is also important, but to recognize that we are standing in the presence of Hashem. In source 27, I was very excited to find this. The Shlach Kadosh, who was born in the mid-1500s, he writes that tefillah is a full-body experience. And he also quotes the pasuk, "Kol atzmosai tamarna, Hashem yichamoch." My whole body screams out, "Hashem, I'm praising you." And he writes, with this kavana, we can actually add in the neshama to the guf of tefillah. As we know, tefillah without kavana is like a guf without neshama. Well, if we have this physical action, if our whole body screams out, it can be a wake-up call, not just to prepare before davening, by having the proper place, the proper setting, the proper time, the proper focus, but also making sure to have significance behind the banging. What's going on? To remind ourselves what it is we're trying to accomplish when we daven. I have this list over here that I'm very excited. I'll be happy to send to anyone who's interested and who thinks it might be helpful to look at the list and alternate. Often there's conflicting things, to shuckle, to not to shuckle, to look at it. I'm going to post this on YU Torah. You can get it from there, or I'll put my email in the chat in just a second, and anyone who wants a copy of this can absolutely email me, and I'll be so happy to share this with you. Look it over. Look at the different ideas and alternate. As long as anything becomes monotonous, we can lose sight of just how important it is to take turns every so often, just to shake things up, literally, to shake things up and to start seeing things in a new way. The more we change it up, the more we find ourselves physically involved and incorporate all of our body, kol atzmo osai tamarna. If we can get all of our body involved, that can really help with kavana. So hopefully this will give some perspective, give some idea of just how we can properly assist our kavana during davening. We started off with a question about, kavana so important during davening, what can we do to improve it? And we said not only preparing beforehand, but actually using the things we're doing anyway as a wake-up call, but it requires preparation as well. It requires knowing what's behind that alarm, what's behind the things that we do. So when we have not just the slach lanus, but 100 reminders during davening, every bow, whenever our feet feel uncomfortable, every time we're doing something, it's a built-in reminder for our Shmona Esrei. As a plug for next week I plan to get back to what I advertised originally of davening without kavanah. Sometimes these don't work. And what happens then? What exactly is the value of tefillah when we have absolutely no kavanah, which is often the case? So please join us again next week as we move on to talk about tefillah without kavanah.